From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Crowdfunding is a relatively new term, but the concept isn't that new. An expert from UNC explains how crowdfunding helped boost North Carolina's economy more than a century ago. Some pundits and politicians on the political left want to boost the government-mandated minimum wage all the way to $15 per hour. You'll learn why that idea would mean bad news for teenagers, the poor, and the least skilled North Carolina workers. Plus, you'll hear from a couple of speakers offering advice to conservative college-age women. One offers helpful tools for engaging in public debates. The other challenges conservative women on college campuses to fight political correctness. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
24.3%. That is the average rate hike that Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina says it will impose for 2017 on North Carolinians who buy an Obamacare insurance plan through the company. Now, the sticker shock reflects what's happening across the country as the Obamacare bad news just keeps on coming. Catherine Restrepo is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Healthcare Policy. She joins us now with the latest on Obamacare. Catherine, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
So this Blue Cross Blue Shield rate hike is really staggering. And doesn't it actually follow another staggering hike from last year?
Yes. The AP and the White House just reported, well, since yesterday, that the average benchmark plans or the second lowest cost silver plans on these exchanges, which really those are the plans that determine how much someone receives as a subsidy based on their income. So those benchmark plans, on average, they're increasing by 25%. And that's a big deal because in the past years, while we've seen overall average increases of double digits, those have typically been lower. Employer plans are also really in the single-digit increases. But when we look at the individual market, it's this recurring theme that's happening, that these double-digit premium increases are happening. People are being stuck with higher out-of-pocket expenses in addition to much higher premiums. And that's not the way health insurance should be structured. I mean, there's nothing wrong with high-deductible health plans, which are what a majority of the plans are on the exchanges now, but typically they come with lower premiums. So there needs to be a better restructuring of the exchanges for this to be a sustainable market at all.
And, of course, the irony from those who believe that there's a better way other than the government program called Obamacare is that its real name is the Affordable Care Act.
Yes.
So that's a little bit sadly ironic and frustrating for sure.
Absolutely.
Tell us, here in North Carolina, about how many people are going to be affected by this rate increase?
Mm-hmm. Well, really, so the White House is trying to sort of, just tone down the situation by saying these are the underlying premium increases. So this isn't when subsidies are factored in.
They say that's kind of like if you buy something off the rack, that's not really the price that someone's going to pay.
Right.
Because some people will have subsidies that will lower
their
cost.
Exactly. So depending on your income, you can qualify for a subsidy that offsets the cost of your premium, and in some cases, it can even offset the cost of your out of pocket payments, like your coinsurance or even towards your deductible. So that really is dependent on your income. So for if you think about it, for an individual making around $25,000 a year who doesn't have health insurance through their job, and they purchase a health insurance plan on the exchanges, they really do benefit. They're really not paying a lot out of pocket, and their monthly premium is heavily subsidized. But for the rest of the exchange population, anybody really making above $30,000, when you're just looking at the individual level, and I'm just saying individuals because I've been looking up on healthcare.gov ever since yesterday or 2 days ago, people can sort of look around and compare prices and out-of-pocket sharing with what their plan may cost when they sign up for 2017. But it's really unaffordable. Even with subsidies, it's really not affordable for a lot of people. So I feel like when the media says, well, 90% of people in North Carolina qualify for financial assistance, I think that a lot of people are sort of lost in the mix there because that's such a blanket statement to say that health insurance is affordable for those 90%.
This is happening across the country, is it not?
Yes. It's not just a problem in North Carolina. This is a problem nationwide. I mean, I think in Oklahoma, you're seeing an average 66% rate increases. In New Mexico, it's like 100%. I mean, it's insane.
What has gone wrong? Because the promise of the Affordable Care Act, mm-hmm. Obamacare, was that this would cost us all less money. We'd be receiving more and better care, and everything was going to be great as soon mm-hmm. as the government got involved and put in place the mandate that we all have to buy an insurance policy or face a penalty. So why hasn't that happened?
Right. Well, there are so many overlapping variables that have contributed to this mess. I mean, it really is a death spiral in the works. You have really, for these exchanges to be sustainable, the Obama administration predicted from the get-go, before these exchanges opened for enrollment for the first time in 2014 of January, that about 40% of the enrollees had to be the young invincible population, or the young, healthy, low users of the healthcare system to offset the risk that insurance companies had to take on for the first time, the higher risk, because they couldn't deny anybody with a pre-existing health condition. So that's a problem. In North Carolina, nationwide, we're only seeing about a quarter of enrollees in that young, invincible age band between 18 and 34-year-olds. Who are actually signing up for these plans.
So the estimate was that in order for this to be sustainable, 40% was mm-hmm. the level of the so-called young invincibles.
Yes.
They're going to pay, but they're not going to use very
yes.
many services.
And, yes, and there's so many other factors. For example, all of these special enrollment periods, people are being able to game the system by signing up for health insurance. It's like this pent-up demand for healthcare in some cases because, in fairness, it's very difficult in the past for people with pre-existing health conditions if they're priced out of the insurance market. I mean, that's a serious issue, but I think that could have been handled a lot differently to find more feasible solutions and sustainable solutions to fix that problem.
In fact, wasn't that actually happening here in North
yes,
Carolina
a lot
before
of,
Obamacare?
Yes, a lot of states had their own federally funded and state-funded high-risk pools for people with severe chronic illnesses. And I mean, of course, there's going to be holes in any system, but for the most part, it was working fairly well. Now, going back to the, you know, other factors that are mm-hmm. contributing to the unsustained, like the volatility of this market. So you have the young invincible signing up, but then going back to the special enrollment period, people are able to sign up at different points of the year, you know, not just during their enrollment period window. They're able to use healthcare services for 3 months at a time, not pay their premiums, and drop their plan. And then the insurance providers and the doctors are on the hook for those expenses that have been incurred.
That just defies common sense, that you can
yes.
use the service and just refuse to pay?
Yes.
Does anything
so
happen to you?
No. There's a three-month grace period where enrollees are allowed to do that and they're not hit with the individual mandate fine, the penalty for not having health insurance.
These younger people, healthier people who are not signing up at the levels that the system really requires mm-hmm. for this to have any chance of working, what are they doing? Are they just paying this penalty?
Mm-hmm. You know, I really don't know the actual estimates or the numbers on that or, you know, the different age groups of people opting out and just willing to pay the penalty and forego health insurance. I'm really not sure, but I do know that I think that young, healthy people who don't have insurance through their job would be much more attractive to plans if you have, okay, fine, have a high deductible, but have a lower premium that's affordable. I mean, I was just looking today on healthcare.gov, and a 26-year-old starting out making $30,000 a year, male, he would qualify for a subsidy, but he, on net, his premium would still be around $122 a month for a catastrophic plan with, I think, a $6,000 or $7,000 deductible. So, you know, lower your premium, and if you're still willing to pay that deductible, that's what an insurance policy ought to look like.
And that's where Obamacare stands as of this sign-up period right now. We've been talking with Catherine Restrepo. She is the Director of Healthcare Policy for the John Locke Foundation. Catherine, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. You might have heard the word crowdfunding in recent years, but though the term is relatively new, the concept is not. Our next guest recently addressed the John Locke Foundation's Shaftesbury Society on the role of crowdfunding during a key period in North Carolina's economic past. Brent Lane is director of the UNC Center for Competitive Economies. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mitch. Glad to be here.
So crowdfunding, people have probably heard about this. Our legislature talked about this during its most recent session, and the concept has been around for a few years in terms of the name crowdfunding. But you say that crowdfunding really played a role back in the late 19th century in North Carolina.
Yeah, I've enjoyed the attention that crowdfunding has been receiving lately. Because I'm aware that in North Carolina's own tradition, it's been a very important role in our economic development. After the Civil War and the devastation that resulted from that, the state and its investors were really bereft of capital and decided the only way out of their economic situation was to pull themselves up by their own bootstraps and invest in manufacturing. But there was a recognition that we lacked the institutions, the financial resources, and really the wealthy class to invest in industrialization. So an alternative strategy was developed, and that was to pool capital from many small investors across North Carolina and build manufacturing plants, textile plants, tobacco plants, furniture plants that became really the economic center of the small towns that still dominate the North Carolina landscape. So small investors would pool quite often through investments of as little as 50 cents a week, investment in a local mill, construct a textile mill that would employ local workers, that would use locally grown cotton and produce textiles that would then be sold across the U.S. and around the world. And the result was that profits were being imported back into the state, back into the pockets of the many investors in these small towns, created the kind of wealth that has sustained many of them through some of the most recently troubled economic times.
Was this a new concept at that time, or was it a revival of something that had been used in the past?
Well, I'm sure throughout economic history, people have pooled their investment when they had the means to do so. What was remarkable about this was the breadth of this as both a public-spirited campaign led by community leaders through a purely private enterprise model. There was a recognition that this was not a government role, but this was something that communities could do to benefit themselves economically, and collectively they would benefit as well. It's been, I think, a remarkable success story in North Carolina that we have forgotten about. We think of industrialization in North Carolina as being a fairly recent phenomenon, one that's a result of companies moving here from elsewhere. But the wave of local investment and local enterprise that began in the 1880s and really continued through the early 1900s built an economy and textiles and furniture and tobacco products that sustained the state for a century. And in many ways accounts for the physical and the economic and the political geography we still have in North Carolina. That's why North Carolina, amongst the largest states in the nation, has the largest share of population in rural areas. We are in many ways still a state of small towns and Mayberries. And at the heart of those towns was an industrial plant, a factory built with local capital, employing local workers, using local inputs.
We're chatting with Brent Lane, who is director of the UNC Center for Competitive Economies. You mentioned that this was done through the private sector. I think some people listening today might think, well, how did that happen on its own without the government being involved? What was sort of the spark that convinced these people to go ahead and pool their resources in this way?
Well, there were a handful of highly influential, what we at the university unfortunately would call thought leaders, who were engaged in not only business but in local government across the state. And they recognized that there was no economic salvation coming to North Carolina but what they produced for themselves. So there was a broadly orchestrated campaign using the media available at the time, just as we use social media now to promote things like crowdfunding, the relatively new social media of the period, the newspapers. Provided an outlet for organizing people and sponsoring the sort of local collective investment that characterized that time period.
We're talking about rural North Carolina and the fact that the way that it looks today is shaped largely by what happened during that time period. A lot of people have been talking about struggles of rural North Carolina today. Do we need something like what we saw in the late 1800s again?
Well, the thing I like to remind my colleagues at Chapel Hill is that the concepts of innovation and entrepreneurship are not new ideas in North Carolina. They've been part of our state economic history across the state throughout its history. In fact, the sort of industries that were being created in the 19th century through this collective investment, they were some of the high-tech industries of the period. The textile mills were using the new technologies of the period. They were using steam. They were early adopters of electricity. These were highly entrepreneurial, technologically sophisticated industries. There are still many opportunities to do that across North Carolina, including in our rural areas. One of the things that I emphasize is that our rural areas are not monolithic. There are a number of very successful companies being built today. The generation of economic leadership in rural North Carolina is in the small and fast-growing companies that we see dotted across North Carolina.
Now, the John Locke Foundation certainly is always happy to hear someone talking about the private sector leading the way and being involved in this. But the government can play a role in helping these businesses thrive and move forward. What's the proper role for the government in this?
Well, we have for the last 30 years focused primarily on industrial recruitment as a government function in economic development. Fortunately, the last few years, we have focused not only on recruitment but also on taking care of the businesses that are already here by making sound changes and simplifications in our tax code and our regulatory policy, things that reduce the friction facing every form of employer across North Carolina. I believe we're starting to see the benefits of that strategy. We had spent the last 20 years where per capita income in the state was declining relative to the rest of the U.S., but in the last 4 years, we've seen an increase in per capita income. We are seeing economic gains across North Carolina in small towns and in large across industry. In part, I think it's because we've improved the climate for small business and existing industry across North Carolina. That's the kind of systemic approach that we need to make sure we continue to take.
Turning back to the whole crowdfunding issue with which we started, we saw some legislation dealing with crowdfunding in the General Assembly this year. Is this likely to have a major impact in North Carolina, or is it just going to be one piece of many things that need to happen to help our economy thrive?
The movement on crowdfunding is encouraging because it taps into the spirit that people have that they want to participate in their economy, not only as employees but also as investors. I think we should have limited expectations of what's going to occur in crowdfunding initially, but it does point to the opportunity we have, which was to enable more people to become capitalists. As what happened in North Carolina over 100 years ago, people became investors in their local economy. They benefited not only as employees, but as capitalists themselves. And I think if anything we learned from that period is that more capitalism by more capitalists is the best way to have more economic benefits for more people.
And so if history doesn't repeat itself, perhaps it rhymes.
There is a cadence to history as well as in the discussions of history. I find within North Carolina's own economic past, there are many lessons that inspire and edify us. I far rather look to examples in our own economic past than to try to copy things that may be occurring in other states. We have had many successes across North Carolina's economic history. A few of them were the result of government, but primarily the result of entrepreneurship and the private enterprise system. I expect that will continue to be the salvation of the state and something we need to enable more people to participate in.
That is the voice of Brent Lane. He is director of the UNC Center for Competitive Economies. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mitch.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at carolinajournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at carolinajournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at carolinajournal.com.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today, buy something nice, and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Conservative women from college campuses recently converged in Raleigh. They heard from experts assembled by the Claire Booth Luce Policy Institute. One expert, Becky Gray of the John Locke Foundation, she dispensed a key piece of advice.
Live in reality. This movement that you all are committed on, that we have committed our lives to, it's not easy. It can be ugly. I've been called things on Twitter that I can't even repeat, even just among us girls. You will be attacked. You will be accused of things that you didn't do, you didn't say. Things that you say will be misconstrued. Things that you said will be twisted around. It's not easy. It's hard. Live in reality and understand that this is what it's going to be. But if you are committed to it, if you're doing what you love, if you're doing what your life mission is, if you've equipped yourself with the ideas and the thoughts and are able to communicate those ideas, you'll be fine.
Gray also emphasized listening skills.
You have to listen to the other people. You have to, I think sometimes in these, and I see this a lot on cable TV, people are involved in an exchange of ideas and they just yell at each other. And you can tell, you know, they're not listening to each other. It's important to listen. If you're going to communicate and if you're going to make the most effective arguments and debates and points that you can, you have to listen to the other person. You have to kind of put yourself in their shoes. Where are they coming from? You know, kind of put yourself where they are. Live in that reality. Don't forget to listen to other people. You know, you're not going to come out of the box and you're not going to succeed on every issue that you want to do. It doesn't happen overnight. You know, we may be right. We may have the best ideas. We may communicate them really well. But you walk out of here and you're going to walk into a buzzsaw. And so a lot of these ideas, a lot of these big ideas, a lot of these big movements, it's incremental. It's taken years to move through this. I've been working on an eminent domain, public, private property, constitutional amendment ever since the Kelo decision came down. So for years, we've been working on that. We're still not there. We'll hope next year that we'll get there. So many of these things you have to work on, incremental, compromise, chip away at the problem, chip away at the fight, take what you can get, and then gear up for the next fight, because believe me, it'll be there tomorrow. And also in reality, you have to understand that this fight for freedom, this fight for liberty, this fight for personal responsibility goes on every single day. The left isn't going anywhere. They are well-financed. They are they outman us in many of these fights. They're going to be there. This is something that we have to get up every single day and commit to and fight.
That's Becky Gray of the John Locke Foundation. She's offering advice to conservative college women. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Conservatives are outnumbered on college campuses. The number of openly conservative women, even smaller. But conservative female college students gathered recently in Raleigh. They heard from people like Kate Obenshain, an author and political activist. She urged college women to fight political correctness.
There is no more important battleground in the entire country than college campuses. Because right now on college campuses, you all are being completely shut down, or there's an attempt to completely shut you down, to silence you in the name of political correctness. Now, I ask you right now to completely and totally reject the drivel, the complete nonsense that is political correctness. Speech codes, free speech zones, trigger warning, sensitivity training, bias incident review committees. This call for civility in our discourse, it is anathema to freedom. And you need to let that sink in deeply, because you are being told right now that what colleges are trying to do is promote kindness and goodness. And let's just... yes, we want people to talk, but there are certain lines that we do not want you to cross. We don't want people's feelings to be hurt, because this is a college campus, after all, and feelings, Feelings are very important. Words matter. You hear that a lot. Words matter. And we have to be very careful that we don't step on anybody's toes. That is complete and total BS. And you all need to call it that.
College is not about keeping your ideas to yourself.
You are on college campuses, for Pete's sake. That is where you're supposed to offend some people. You're supposed to step on some toes. You're supposed to say exactly what you think. You're supposed to say what you think wherever you are. If you believe it firmly and you want to share it, you should be able to speak the words. You know what? If somebody says something genuinely hateful, and somebody really believes some hateful, dark stuff, and they have these plans in their mind about how they're going to become elected, and they want to implement this evil vision, you want them talking about that. You want them. You want to know what they think, primarily so that you can use your good sense and your compassion and your energy to combat those ideas. It's when we are silenced that no longer do we have the free and open exchange of ideas that is the very premise for our nation. This notion that this is kind and good and respectful, please reject that.
Openshain discussed the heated nature of modern political debate.
You all are kind and good people, and none of us like to be called these nasty names. The nasty names, by the way, that conservatives have been called on college campuses for decades. But Barack Obama really made it acceptable. When he started calling his opposition, the conservatives' opponents, he started calling them enemies. And he called them terrorists. And he said that they don't care about children with Down syndrome or with defects or old people. When he crossed that line, he no longer said, and the Democrats and the liberals no longer say, all right, we have policy differences with you, and this is why we disagree with you on, say, raising taxes. We think they should be raised because so-and-so. No, they say that Republicans or conservatives, because Republicans don't always agree with conservatives, that's for sure, but that conservatives are evil because of what they think. They are morally flawed. So because we want to keep taxes low, we hate poor people and we love rich people. But we actually hate poor people and we want to keep them down.
That's the voice of Kate Openshain, speaking recently in Raleigh for a conference sponsored by the Claire Booth Luce Policy Institute. Openshain explained the reason for the verbal attacks.
They cannot combat our position with ideas, and so they have to vilify anybody who disagrees with them. And once they convince people that anybody who wants to keep taxes low hates poor people, they've done their job. So now if Paul Ryan, who very courageously a couple years ago said, okay, we're going to reform entitlements. Instead of engaging in an open conversation about the pros and cons and what we need to do to actually save our entitlement program, Social Security, Medicaid, the liberals did this ad. One ad. One ad is all it took. Pushing this a Paul Ryan lookalike, pushing this little old lady up a hill and shoving her off a cliff. It was a very graphic and disturbing ad. You know what happened? Completely shut down the entire notion of reforming our entitlements. That was it. The Republicans, so-called Republicans, the so-called conservatives, they ran as fast as they could in the other direction. What they should have done is said, we're not going anywhere. Who's pushing the little old lady off the cliff? It's the people who want to drive, right, I know. It's the people who want to drive our entitlements out of existence and put us into bankruptcy. Those are the people who want to shove, because what are you going to do with all the little old ladies when you have no more entitlements?
Openshain turned the focus back toward the college campus.
This is that political correctness that has become part of not only college campuses, but now our society. You guys have to take it on in that microcosm where you are, where it's just this hotbed of hatred coming from the left. I mean, the stuff that they come out with and the way they're trying to shut you down and silence you should be so offensive to you that if you dare speak outside the political orthodoxy, you say something that contradicts what their leftist sort of rabid craziness is, then you guys are hateful. Please stop, turn around, and combat those ideas one after another with your reason. and with your courage. And that's probably the most important characteristic that you're going to need in order to be able to take on the political correctness police that are running amok on your campuses.
So what can students do?
The first step in being courageous on campuses is raising your hand in a class and disagreeing with the professor. It is something that basic, and that is super hard, I know it. But it is super important. And you know what? You will say, I don't know, whatever the subject is, you know, I actually believe that global warming is a theory and it's not a proven fact. Y'all might all disagree with me. We might have lost that one by now. Oh my gosh. This is a really big one. I believe marriage should be between a man and a woman. Oh my gosh. And you just go like this. Or I believe that illegal immigration, it poses a threat to our national security. How about that one? And people will look at you like, oh my gosh, did she just say that? Oh my gosh. And you'll get this, and the professor will probably shut you down. But I promise you, there are people in that room who agree with you. And they just don't have the guts to stand up and say it. Or there are people who have never, ever heard that perspective expressed. And suddenly they're going to start thinking, oh my gosh, there is an alternative. There's another way to think about things. That is a hugely impactful moment that you have just had. That is dramatic change that you, one person, has just affected, not just in that classroom. I promise you, it's going way beyond that classroom.
That's conservative author and political activist Kate Obenshain speaking recently in Raleigh to a group of college women. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
At the John Locke Foundation, we're leading the effort to clean up the mess left behind by big government liberals. For decades, the powerful left in our state had piled on rule after rule, regulation after regulation, never really caring about the people whose lives are caught in the nightmare of complying. In other words, you. Their handiwork had made it tougher to get a job, even increased the legal risk of operating a business. We say enough is enough, that it's just not fair to you. That's why reform-minded lawmakers have turned to the Locke Foundation for answers, and they've acted to lighten your burden. We're proud that our intellectual firepower has improved lives. You can count on the John Locke Foundation to watch out for your interests, not the special interests. We would be honored to have your help in this fight. Go to johnlocke.org and make a tax-deductible donation right now. The John Locke Foundation. We're fighting for you. We're fighting for freedom. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. Want to keep North Carolinians working? Then you need to reject the notion that raising the government-mandated minimum wage to $15 per hour, as some have proposed. That's the conclusion of a new report that looks at the economic research related to minimum wage mandates. It's a report written by our next guest. John Sanders is Director of Regulatory Policy for the John Locke Foundation. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, Donna.
So exactly what do we mean when we say the mandated minimum wage? Who's mandating that and what is it?
Well, the federal government has mandated that the lowest that an hourly wage can go for most workers is $7.25 per hour. There are some exceptions for, you know, like tipped wait staff and things like that. But for the most part, $7.25 per hour. And the state of North Carolina has set their law so that the minimum wage here, according to state law, is the federal minimum wage.
Okay. So any business in North Carolina then has to pay at least $7.25 an hour, unless it's one of those categories you just mentioned, waiters and waitresses, things like that. Okay. So who wants it to be higher than $7.25?
Well, in the last few years, it's become an issue among Obama, the president, and the Democrats in Congress, and then also for Democrats in the state level, and Moral Monday activists and liberal activists.
What is their argument for raising the mandated minimum wage?
Their argument is the idea that if we make wages higher by law, then everyone will make more money. That is essentially, I think, what they think is going to happen. So they see it as something out of compassion, that they are making things better for the lowest earning workers in the state. However, the research for it, there's, you know, employers as well as employees, and there are economic realities at stake here that make it so that the actual effect of raising the minimum wage hurts those who are most in need of it.
It's interesting, their argument, John, because I think anyone with a heart who wants people to do well would say, yeah, that would be great if my friend who's struggling right now could make more money working at, you know, his job at the factory or his job in that office down the street. And, of course, we self-interested folks, which we all are, would like to make more money. But I think your point is an important one that you outlined in your report. And you say that despite those good intentions, wanting people to make more money, that really doing this hurts the very people that the advocates are trying to help. Explain how that's possible.
Well, first off, there's only about 5% of workers in North Carolina who are at the minimum wage, as it is currently set. Those are, in general, startup workers, teenagers, people with low skills, people with their first jobs. So these are people generally are not earning higher wages because they're just now finding their value in the workplace. The problem with raising the minimum wage, especially to very high numbers, the increases that are being talked about now are not just slight boosts or cost of living adjustments in minimum wage. They are, if it's up to $15 an hour, it's over 100%. So you're talking about a very large increase. If it were to go that high, that would impact over 40% of workers because people are earning $9 an hour, $10 an hour, $12 an hour, all of those people would be impacted by a minimum wage being jumped up to $15 an hour.
Now, if an employer was required to increase that minimum wage level, the person who actually is getting that increase, they're going to benefit right then because they're going to be getting a bigger paycheck.
That's right.
So where does the negative economic impact kick in?
Well, to sound like an economist for a minute, those workers who retain their jobs will do so because employers see that their value is greater than the current wage that they're getting. So if they continue, if they get minimum wage when it's double what it was, then employers, by that definition of it, have decided that they are worth it. What happens is, and what has happened in previous instances of high increases in the minimum wage, is that especially teenagers, low-skilled individuals find it harder to find employment because employers are not judging their abilities to be worth that amount. So they get left out or they get paid under the table, or employers just say, automation here in this instance could be better. I just saw an article today about Wendy's restaurants is starting to think about moving into kiosks in several places because they're not going to be able to afford wage. They're worried about minimum wage being increased so much, and that's happened in several other places.
So if someone is an employer, John, and they're looking at this possibility, if this were to actually happen, and there have been calls from those on the left to increase this mandated minimum wage up to $15 an hour, they're probably looking at the folks that they employ in an entry-level position making that minimum wage and saying, no matter what, it could be the most wonderful person in the world who has a lot of potential, and I really want that person to work here for me, but the entry-level job that they're doing, I simply can't justify paying that amount of money for it. How do we try to help people who are advocating for this big increase to understand that that is the economic reality of an employer?
I try to, in my work, in my writing, to explain the situation, explain the economics of it. It's just an instance, and there are so many other instances like this in the literature where what sounds good has unintended negative consequences that just work out in the real world. And this is a kind of a bad instance of that, because for the most part, people who want this really do care about their fellow man, but they don't look at the long-term effects. I've seen some research that if the minimum wage were to go up to $15 an hour, that it would disemploy over 300,000 North Carolinians. Because, again, over 40% of people in North Carolina earn an hourly wage up to $15 an hour. So how many people were impacted. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the median wage in North Carolina is $15.91. So that's the median. That's not the average. That shows how much an impact $15 an hour floor would have.
John, what's the recommendation then for folks who think, you know, we've got to figure out a way to make sure that people are lifted up, that they can earn a higher wage and be more self-sufficient? What is the answer if it's not a government mandate?
Well, one of the answers, I think, would be to make sure that people are learning soft skills, things that make them employable. Soft skills are such things as understanding just timeliness and promptness and courteousness and good service and respect for your employers.
Things that lead to a promotion.
Yeah, things that lead to a promotion that tell your employer that you care about the job. Working on education so that people are more educated and more able to handle different kinds of things that come their way.
John, appreciate you joining us. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for Carolina Journal Radio this week. Thanks for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.